Arrow considered the notion her hooves with a deep countenance. "Riddle me this," it read. "Your arrow cast are where roaming delights go to die, where the Pied Piper's music has played its final encore, and dreams melt into the dusty ground. Summer laments your friend's sticky situation." Now, she considered the riddle for a long, long time. Roaming delights, melting, music, the summer. I mean, the summer is hot, music is nice, cold things melt, delights taste good. Of course, must be the abandoned ice cream truck depository on Clax Lane. The Aerocast were locked in an ice cream truck in the middle of the industrial sprawl. It was spooky as fuck, like something out of Silent Hill or Goosebumps. The Orange 95 Sunfire was illegally parked at the loading dock. The Aerocast were strapped to the seats of the ice cream truck, being forced to watch Shrek 9 and eat stale Cheetos. Epona boasted from a loudspeaker. "So, my finicky young feline, you've managed to find my villainous lair. Three of the hardest Zelda puzzles ever conceived await you. Completion of each puzzle awards a key to one of the three locks on the ice cream truck door. Three locks, three keys, and your friend's freedom." Arrow stepped forward. "Bring it on." "So be it," said Epona, with a very evil and spooky voice. Arrow entered the first room, a long hallway with a tall ceiling. Arrow immediately looked up, knocked her bow, and shot the eyeball that was slightly out of her initial vision. The next door opened and a key dropped to the floor. The next room had a mural of a conductor in a baby's cradle. A triforce was etched onto the side of the cradle. Arrow simply hummed the same three notes again and again. For the first time in the history of ever, a puzzle was solved with the greatest song of all time, Zelda's Lullaby. The next door opened, and another key was presented. The third room presented a strange mosaic to Arrow. 16 big painted squares in a 4x4 grid. One square suddenly vanished, and the rest of the squares scrambled themselves. The remaining squares could slide into the empty space, so the mosaic could eventually be complete once more. "Well, fuck this," Arrow muttered. "They have ice cream, they'll be fine." So, this podcast is all about puzzles for June 2019. But before we get to this, I'm Matt, my co-host is Chris. Chris, how's your June been?
My June's been pretty up and down. I've been pretty busy with my personal life, so like most podcast intros, I'm just going to talk about all the games I played. So, I cleared two games this past month. The first one is Dragon Quest II, since I was already pretty much near endgame when I last discussed it. So, not much to say about the ending other than I did a fair bit of farming, because I found out there were three rare items in the game. Two, I believe, were cursed items, but I just wanted them anyway, because, hey, there's only three rare items in this game, and my characters need to level up, so why not? And then the last one was whatever this patch said, it's the Descendants Orbs, which let you save anywhere. I mean, that was kind of useful, but again, I just wanted these rare items to have my cool, sweet, leveled-up party for the final boss. And, the final boss, I think it was Shido, I don't remember the name of it, whatever, it was pretty basic. It's Dragon Quest II, so I don't expect anything spectacular, but in the end, you know, it was a decent game, and yeah, for a while I was interested in getting Dragon Quest III and seeing how the Roto trilogy wraps up, but I think I kind of just wore out my RPG phase for a moment, so maybe that'll be safe for the future.
Yeah, so Dragon Quest II, I've never been all the way through. I'll have to pick it up at some time. Like, I'm the, you know, the idiot that wants to play these games on the original hardware, so I've never seen 2 through 4 available on the NES.
So, well, I should mention I was playing the Super Famicom remakes with patches, so I don't know if I want to go back and try the original originals, but yeah, I felt like those were the prettiest looking ones since the iOS versions or whatever, Steam, Android, that version looked kind of weird. So that was my option.
If the Android stuff's as bad as Final Fantasy VI, then
I don't recall it looking awful. It was just that I was would prefer the Super Famicom sprite work, so that was my idea in playing it.
Does the Super Famicom version then offer any additional content, or is it a straight port of the Famicom version?
I don't think I really looked into what it updated besides the graphics and stuff. Maybe a few little extras. But yeah, I wouldn't be able to answer offhand.
Okay.
you can say I look prettier, but I just also have a huge bias for the Super Famicom, Super Nintendo era sprite work, so that's a thing.
I kind of like the NES sprite work for Dragon Quest, though. I wouldn't say it's not pretty, but I guess that's a very subjective
thing. It's a charming factor, yeah. So,
yeah.
To each their own. Of course, the game we can really talk about that I cleared is I finally cleared Sekiro, you know, weeks after everyone else who bought it on release date cleared it. Yeah, it was finally my turn. So, I guess I still want to keep it vague, even though you know exactly what I'm talking about anyway. But yeah, endgame was pretty cool. I had the worst frame rate experiences at the last area, and that made me contemplate getting a PS4 Pro. I don't know, maybe, we'll see. But, yeah, the final bosses, one was okay, I guess, but the real final boss that I encountered was really cool. It's one of my favorite fights, even though my real favorite fight of the game from what I experienced so far, because there's two different paths, essentially, still had the save. That was cool.
Yeah, I would say the final, like, real final boss is probably the better fight in the game, and it's very subjective, it's very subjective as to what people consider the most difficult boss in Sekiro, because there's a slower boss that people seem to have a lot more trouble with. I'll edit this out, but a lot of people have trouble with. I would say it's one of the hardest bosses by any measure, but some people rank him like that. But it's about how they can recognize or react to their particular patterns, and sometimes, especially in FromSoft games, if you're used to fast enemies, sometimes enemies with a little bit of a delay or what have you are actually a lot more difficult because you're, you know, trying to parry early. For me, the final boss was the most difficult fight in the game. Maybe not talking about the initial struggles with Lady Butterfly or what have you, because I tried her for a while before I got it. It's sort of those early stumbling blocks of learning how to play the game. But if you look at everyone in a vacuum in the technical necessity for beating them, I'd say that the final boss of that path is the most difficult fight in the game, at least. And that's kind of different for a FromSoft game, because it's usually the hidden bosses that are more difficult, and I just don't rate that in this game.
Well, of course, there's no DLC yet, so that might bring out some new surprises.
I just want to say I don't know if I count DLC against the main game, but I then again, if I look at Dark Souls 3 or Bloodborne, I do. So, I mean, I guess there's that.
Yeah, well, just to go off topic, for Bloodborne also has its whole different category of what are difficult bosses if I consider all the Chalice Dungeons and their setups, so that's a whole other topic, I suppose. But I guess in reflection of what my challenging bosses were, of course Lady Butterfly, but she was the very first boss in the game for me, so that was kind of expected. This is a bit of a running gag, but any enemy with a spear, which are mini-bosses, would kick my ass. Thanks, Seven Spears of Ashina. But then I guess I would say the third most difficult boss fight was one of those hidden boss fights. But at some point I went a little wild and said, I'm not going to heal during this because I guess, I don't know, challenge. I died a lot of that, so it's really hard to say. I don't know. The final boss, I did die pretty often, but I don't know. It's really difficult for me to assess how well I did in Sekiro just because of, you know, how it was growing and what kind of skills I had available and how much preparation I had. I guess that's really cool about Sekiro, too. So I guess to give an overall review of Sekiro, even though still got that other path to do, and there's probably more surprises there. Overall, I did like Sekiro a lot. The combat is really good. It was a big refresher. I like being stealthy in the beginning of the game, and once I got far more confident and had more skills, then I could be more active and run into enemies and use all the deflection available and stuff like that, so that was really fun. I guess level design was give or take, but I'm always like that with From Software games because I'll really like an area at one time and then I'll get to the next one and hate it again.
I find a lot of the areas are quite pretty, but it's the grappling hook just makes them, it makes some of the level design a bit moot, I find, but I think it's pretty good.
There were a lot of interesting enemy encounters. So I guess there, from what there was in the vast selection before it starts getting really palette swappy in ways, I just like the enemies in Sekiro. I think they all have their different ways of how you approach them and what you want to do with them and taking them down. But yeah, I'm looking forward to a harder game and seeing how I take on these enemies now without getting hit, because I guess deflect is, or I should say blocking is going to be more of an issue now and stuff like that.
And then Elden Ring's going to come out, going to be the complete opposite direction, and you'll have to
learn everything again.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, so in my personal ranking of the From Software games that I've played, probably under Bloodborne, but above Dark Souls 3. Because I do appreciate them taking a different approach to it. It is a Tenchu spiritual successor, so I like that aspect of it. Just, you know, Bloodborne, I guess the Chalice Dungeons are a big thing to me for Bloodborne, which is why I like a lot, and I do like the setting of Bloodborne more. I mean, just a lot of, these are just personal reasons, but yeah, Sekiro is really good. Yeah, I don't know how much more to say about Sekiro, because then we'd have to go into, like, really spoiler territory, and then I'd just be, like, too in-depth. Just complain about Lightning Reversal for, like, 5 minutes, but no. Finally learned it, though. And I'm gonna be vague about this because you haven't had a chance to play it yet, but Bloodstained came out, and I've been putting some time into that. I would say I'm roughly at 70% map completion with Miriam. Of course, there's gonna be more characters, because that's, I think, pretty much marketed at this point, that, you know, there's other characters in this game and a whole other bunch of stuff going on. So far, I guess I'm back and forth on how I feel about that game, because I sort of kept in the dark about it, and I don't know about you, Matt. I don't, how much did you follow, like, how the game was progressing and stuff?
Nothing. The only thing I followed was when I played Curse of the Moon. Other than that, I'm in the dark about a lot of it.
Okay, so maybe I shouldn't say much about it then?
No, I'm waiting for mine to arrive, so we can have a bit more of a robust conversation about it next month, probably, but...
Okay, yeah. I have a couple of, like, ups and downs about it. Some stuff I really like, even though they're kind of repeat gimmicks, and some stuff I don't like because they're repeat gimmicks, and... you know what, I'm not done with the game yet, so maybe there's still more surprises, but, you know, it's okay game, it's a fun Metroidvania as always. I think we'll go more in-depth when you actually play the game, so I can have, be more critical or be more ecstatic about things. But I'll say so far, like, yeah, it's a good game. Yeah, so I would say I want to probably wait till I clear the game list with Miriam and then have a more fuller review on how I feel about it. But right now, it's, like, it's pretty good. Just, you know, ups and downs, of course, because I'm always critical about everything I ever touch. But, yeah, so I guess we'll leave more of that until maybe next month, hopefully. That's enough about me. What's been going on with you, Matt, besides also waiting for Bloodstained?
Well, I had my Canada Day rained out, so that's...
Oh, yeah, so sorry. We had a good Canada Day, otherwise.
It was fine otherwise, but, yeah. This is the first really shitty weather Canada Day I've remembered for probably a decade, so that was a bit disappointing, but that's what happened. Whatevs. As for what I've been playing, I took into the Iceborne beta demo, which was available initially for PS Plus members and then just this last weekend for this, any PS4 member. So I played this. I like a lot of the changes after doing it. I'm not going to get too in-depth with this. I will say that Banbro, dude as fuck. Beatotis looks cool, but I didn't really flirt it too much because it's another fish.
Oh boy.
Tigrex, not Tigrex. Apparently it's Tigrex, which doesn't make any fucking sense to me. Because it's a tiger. But anyways, that was
like
a good
Alva
fight.
Or something?
Well, Tigrex is a... it's a cross between a tiger and a Tyrannosaurus Rex, and it's a, you know, it's a wyvern, so it's got that body type too.
Okay, so not like Alvin. Okay.
No, not at all. And then, so that was a good fight. Pretty relentless. I did a lot of online fights with Tigrex, which was fun. Using the new Clutch Claw and trying out some of the differences with the weapons. Trying out the new spinning dildo move of the hunting horn. And
yes, of course, you call it that.
Yeah, because, well, anyways. But, like, when I play Iceborne for real, I'm going to main Sword and Shield, Lance, and Hunting Horn. So I'll probably post some videos of Hunting Horn. Because I one of my favorite clips I took of Monster Hunter world was defeating Arctemper Kushala by shoving the wind pressure in the gate song up his arse with the with the hunting horn. So, but I'm digressing. When the demo came back last week, they added Nargacuga as a rare spawn in the Ancient Forest quest. So I fought Nargacuga, super sexy in Monster Hunter World. It's like maybe the best looking monster in the game. Just the fur looks fucking beautiful, and the model is on point.
Okay, let's keep this cast somewhat clean, Matt. I know we can get pretty.
Yeah, that was a great fight. Can't wait to do more of that in the main game. Glavinus has been teased, and Baryoth was just revealed today. So that's the Smilodon saber-toothed tiger monster. So excited about that, too. I fought that one in Monster Hunter Tri. It was one of my favorite monsters in that. So I'm looking forward to that. Moving on from Iceborne, I have played a couple of games. I'm doing sort of a backlog thing every month now, so I'm trying to get through a couple of games every month. Not really long ones, just a couple of games I find interesting and want to clear because I bought them for, you know, for the purpose of clearing them, I may as well start fucking doing that. One of them was Flappy Special, which is an import, a Japanese import for the Game Boy that I originally saw in Classic Game Room back when they were actually doing YouTube videos. And it's, you know, topical. It's a puzzle game. You'll notice that a lot with games I like to get for the Game Boy, where you're a mole that has to push a boulder to the goal and crush enemies with it. And I wrote a bit of an article on it, so I'm not going to get into, you know, exhaustive detail. I'll say that it's got two modes with 80 stages apiece. Mode A is much more puzzle-focused. Mode B is much more enemy and action-focused. And the password system's really easy and clear for the which is, you know, a thumbs up there because for that platform, that's what you need. The music is super monotonous, and moles are really cute. The next game I played through is... I got a perverse nostalgia for this game. It's Alex Kidd, The Lost Stars. And I mean perverse nostalgia, because it's a fucking terrible game. But it's awful, and it's a really bad, shitty platformer. Not quite as bad as I remember, but it was bad all the way through, so... But I just have some nostalgia for it because I played, like, we never finished it that day. We came really close. I was playing with my two brothers. It's been a long time since all three of us were together at the same time in an environment that we could sit down and play games for a couple hours. So my older brother was playing it, beat the stage, celebrating, pumping his fist, he punched himself in the dick. So... I've got the like the worst center of nostalgia for The Lost Stars, but you know, I mean, he found the miracle ball, so I found it too. I beat Alex Kidd. I didn't punch myself in the dick though.
I was gonna ask.
No, not even as a not even as a tribute. I wouldn't do that. I saw a game for the Game Boy, of course. With me, there's these, sometimes I'll see, like, box art for a game that I never heard of, and I'm like, oh, I have to fucking play this. And it was Primitive Princess for the Game Boy, which is a caveman puzzle game where you can, like, you have a limited amount of hammers in every stage, so you can, like, you can knock out certain blocks to drop, so you can go through the floor and crush enemies with them, but you can also, a limited amount of times, depending on the stage, build a new floor in an empty space. So you have to get a crystal in every stage and then make your way to the ladder in the upper right-hand corner. So it's about making your way to the crystal without getting killed by enemies or destroying them on the way, but also without preventing yourself from you know, getting to the exit at the end. You don't want to block yourself. I'd say it's a middle-of-the-road puzzler on the Game Boy. There was a couple of stages that stumped me a little bit. But overall, it has its limitations. It's not super varied. And for that reason, I say it's middle-of-the-road. Compared to, like, I'd say Flappy Special's kind of middle-of-the-road as well. But compared to Mole Mania or Lolo no Daiboken. It's very middle of the road. Finally, the last game I want to talk about is SOS on the Super Nintendo. Now, I can't really get into the nitty-gritty of this game on the podcast because it would take a long time. This is where I plugged my website. I wrote an article on this one. Essentially, it's sort of like the Poseidon Adventure, the game. So you're on a capsized ship, and there's four survivors that you can pick, and they start at different points in the ship. Have certain people that they get their best ending, you have to find and recruit, and then make your way to the exit. Now you can just like exit with just yourself, which just makes the game an interesting platforming experience, or you can try to get up to seven people to get the best ending, which becomes a very tense and dangerous expedition through the ship. And SOS is kind of special in that respect because, like, the environment is really dynamic. Every so often the ship will rumble, like every couple of minutes it'll rumble, and then the whole, you know, it's like a tech demo for SNES environment rotation. The whole ship will turn, and then all of a sudden you can make some jumps easier, and then some jumps become impossible, or you can like crawl up a wall or what have you. So it's a really interesting game. It's, you know, easy for people following you to die. Then again, the game is an hour long without save, so it's one that you want to play again and again and again to get the best ending. If it doesn't get too frustrating, because there's some AI problems, you're just spinning at the bottom of the ladder, AI problems.
Yeah, that's how it is sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah, but it's like, there's nothing else like it on the Super Nintendo. Like, for instance, after about 30 minutes, the ship breaks in half, like, the lights go out, and then, you know, you've been dealing with, like, a 30-degree angle, now all of a sudden, you're dealing with a 270-degree angle or something, and it's fucking wild. Sometimes the ship will just keep turning and turning and turning. Sometimes, you know, the wall is now literally the ceiling. It's a game that I recommend people try. I don't think everyone's going to like it, but in terms of unique Super Nintendo games, give it a shot, and I'd say take a couple of exploratory runs at it without trying to save anyone, just to get your bearings, and then try to save some people. That might frustrate you a bit, but I think the tension of it and the thematic elements of SOS make it a really good game to try out if you're an enthusiast of the platform. It's probably Human Entertainment who would go on to make the first Fear, so, you know, you're in for some disaster.
Yeah, I was about to ask. This sounds really cool, so I was wondering if they made any sequels or successors where the AI would be slightly better, but that kind of answers the question.
There is a sequel on the PlayStation that's in 3D, but I don't know how good it is. It looks a bit slow.
Like, the PlayStation era of games.
Yeah, there's not a lot of information about it, but I'm sure if it's, like, I don't know if they do a whole lot of the rotation stuff, which is like sort of what makes this game so cool. I guess if they had called it Septentrion in English, people still wouldn't know about the game, but they called it SOS, and I remember SOS, a game called SOS Sink or Swim on the Super Nintendo from Nintendo Power, which was a very bright and colorful game. And this is not bright and colorful. But I saw the box art, and I'm like, you know, and the game was a bit pricey, but I hadn't heard of it, and I'm always game to try that kind of stuff. But I saw the box art, and I'm like, well, Phalanx has a fucking farmer playing the banjo. right?
Yeah.
This is a ship in a storm. This could be the same game, and It looked all right. It didn't look fantastic. I'm glad I made the mistake I did, because as frustrating as SOS was at times, I was, you know, especially for an English release Super Nintendo game, like, I've at least been aware of a lot of them, but it's the name of this one being so similar to Sink or Swim that I just passed over it so many times. So that's what I've been playing. But before we stop, Did somebody say McDonald's? Because I gotta say, in Canada, McDonald's with their $3 flurries right now, you know, snack size and regular size flurries were sponsored by McDonald's, by the way. But the Great Canadian Taste, that chocolate Nanaimo McFlurry is fucking sublime. Like, damn. It's like sucking off Olaf from Frozen. No, it's seriously, if you're in Canada, I don't recommend the fish and chips. Everyone says they're terrible, but the other Great Canadian Taste, the chocolate Nanaimo McFlurry, fucking thumbs up. I've had a couple of them, probably more than I should have, so that's it for this for this intro, I guess. Puzzles are challenges that test problem solving, be logic or pattern recognition or object manipulation or any other of a great number of mechanisms. Puzzles can be stimulating, competitive, and a test of rational acuity. The difficulty of puzzles can vary wildly, as well as their platform, be they drawn or written, physical toy, or a roadblock in the game. Either way, they tend to be ingrained in every medium that they touch. So we're going to be talking about puzzle games and puzzle elements this month. It's going to be a pretty relaxed and casual discussion podcast. It's one of those. So we'll talk a little bit about puzzle elements, and we'll talk about some of our favorite puzzle games. But before we get that far, how do you personally define a puzzle game?
What a difficult question. No, it actually would be quite a puzzling thing to say, because when I first think of a puzzle game, I'd probably go with something like Tetris, which is a game about blocks, and you kind of manipulate them and piece them together, then they get cleared, and that sort of applies to a lot of other puzzle games we might be discussing here. So that would be one of the definitions you could say, but then you could also go into, let's say, the genres of point-and-clicks, where puzzle games could be, you know, trying to solve a mystery and getting clues together. How do you get these items to work together to get to the end of the game? And I mean, being a puzzle game, I would say that's kind of still in there, but it could branch in so many different ways, especially when you get into, like, puzzles within action games or puzzles that are in games completely not even related to that. It's a really broad question to ask, but I would definitely just go with my first initial saying is, yeah, maybe the game is like Tetris, where it's about block manipulation and clearing a screen, and often it's co-op, sometimes it's just a single-player experience, but of course it always has so many ways to go about that.
Yeah, it's sort of why I posed the question, is because it's broad, and we will talk about some games that use puzzles as their, as some of their mechanisms, or all of a sudden you're... You mentioned adventure games, like, that's sort of a gray area, right, because everything that you do in a adventure game is problem solving to some degree. However, is a puzzle always the mechanism for it? Or it's a tough question. I think it just shows how prevalent, you know, puzzles are in games, right? I would say my own definition for it is, if solving a puzzle is the predominant mechanism for the game, but then again, do you really solve Tetris? It's, you're sort of problem solving as you go along. You know, where are the Tetronimos going to fit, and you know, how can I build towards as many Tetrises as possible, and things like that. So it's tough to really nail down a definition that fits everything. So, you know, we can't, we'll say that we can't really encompass everything that might be considered a puzzle game, but it does show some leeway, because I think you've got a better variety of puzzle games to talk about than I do, because two of mine are action puzzle games, and, you know, if half the mechanism is action or reflex. Is it always a puzzle in that case? If the games I'm talking about, yes, it is. But, you know, it just it gets a bit nebulous, I suppose.
And sometimes there's even puzzles within the puzzles. Like when you brought up about Tetris, yeah. I was just recalling, like, in Tetris DS where they have that side mission kind of thing where it's like, try to figure out how to clear this line of blocks, but only using, let's say, the T-piece or something like that. And that's kind of, like, an interesting way to just put more puzzles into puzzles, but yeah.
Yeah. Or I'll be talking about The Adventures of Lolo. And every room of that, of course, is a puzzle, but puzzles within puzzles. As small as the rooms in Lolo are, sometimes you have to solve 3 or 4 different puzzles to solve the room, so... You know, it's very flexible, but it's there. We have a general idea. The main mechanism of the game is to solve a puzzle. What is the appeal of puzzles and puzzle games, though?
I think the ultimate appeal of puzzle games is you kind of feel smart about solving one. It's just the joy of saying, I was posed a problem and I got through it. Or if it's something like Tetris, which is also kind of like an action game, there's also the fact that using your reflexes and getting high score, that's also the appeal of it, which happens also a lot with really just the reflex games. But yeah, it's really just the joy of solving something and going through it.
Yeah, I think so. I think the best puzzle games that I've played are games where I've gotten stumped, turned it off, and then later I'm taking a shower or something. It's like, oh, bloody hell, I know what to do now, so I have to go back and do it while I'm thinking about it. So it's those games that, you know, test your rational limits, I guess, your reasoning abilities, and then make you think about the puzzle afterwards, like how you could have improved, say, playing Tetris, or, you know, how are you going to get past this friggin' room? You know, is that going to stump you for too long? And you want to beat the temptation of looking it up, right? Like, you want the sense of accomplishment of getting through it yourself. You want to beat the game. You don't want the game to beat you. And I think that's why people...
That's why people play games in general.
But particularly, it's also why people do crossword puzzles or Sudoku or something like that, right?
Yeah,
it's, it's that particular drive that you want to prove that you can do what this is asking you to do, that you've got the mental acuity for it. So we're going to do a little bit of show and tell, sort of like we do anytime we do a genre. We're just going to loosely talk for a couple of minutes about some of our favorite puzzle games and why we like them and maybe how they're played. So Chris, why don't you get us started?
Yeah, so the first puzzle game in loose terms that I want to talk about is one I've talked about previously on a cast. It's a nostalgic choice. It's the Carmen Sandiego series. And yeah, it is a puzzle game in the loose sense because as a point-and-click game, you need to, you know, talk to the suspects or, you know, talk to any witnesses and try to piece all together all those clues about what the criminal looks like. And I recall if in World, I think it's been a long time since I played a Carmen Sandiego game. Not only do you get clues on what the suspect looks like, because you need to identify them at the end with the warrant, you need to find out where exactly in the world you need to travel to. And, you know, back then, sometimes maybe the clues weren't that clear, especially when you're young and you don't know a lot about the world and geography yet. And I always remember that Carmen Sandiego was like, oh, maybe you should check an almanac or dig up those encyclopedias because Wikipedia did not exist yet. So it was a very educational part of, like, solving things. I mean, you learned a lot, and, you know, as a kid, I just remember, like, writing down clues and trying to, like, piece together what the suspect could look like. Oh, he has a blue shirt or sunglasses, something like that. When you're 6 years old, or whatever, how old I was, like, you know, that's just, like, a lot of information to take in. Like, you know, just being a detective when you're young. And that was just a lot of fun for me. You know, you learn so much, especially when, at that age and the different series you got. There was a USA one. I don't recall if I ever got the Europe one. I think there was also Time was out when I was at that age, but I don't recall if I played it. I definitely remember the TV show, though, which was just adding to, you know, how much you learned and how big Carmen Sandiego was at the time.
Yeah, I think I only remember the TV show because I didn't actually play any of the games. Yeah, so, like I say, I missed out in that respect.
I mean, I guess it would be fun to come back to it now that you're older. I don't know how relevant information would be nowadays, but at the same time, you know, when you're older, you'd probably piece together things faster. It's just fun to experience. But yeah, as a puzzle game, just to put those clues together and solve the mystery, that was really interesting to me, and it was really fun, and that is essentially what a lot of point-and-click games are, in a way, unless they involve the more strange puzzles like the LucasArts games, but that's not what I'm going to talk about. I'm just talking about, you know, getting that information and, you know, using my six-year-old mind to put things together and arrest Carmen Sandiego in the end.
So, in other words, there were no Sierra-level consequences for that first Carmen Sandiego.
I don't know if you, like, kept getting the wrong suspect, you would get in trouble and, like, fail the mission, but it wasn't, like, something horrible. I mean, there were still saves back then, but yeah, it was still a lot of fun. I'm sure I got things wrong in the past, but yeah.
And you're talking about, like, trying to solve the crimes. Do you consider riddles the same as puzzles?
Yeah, riddles are definitely the same as puzzles, and I'll get to that in another series I'll talk about later.
Sure. So the first game I want to talk about, I didn't want to talk about Tetris at length because everyone talks about Tetris, and I think everyone talks about this game as well, but I want to talk about Dr. Mario, mostly because it is my mother's favorite game. You know, in its simplest terms, like stripped down, Dr. Mario is just—it's simply a color matching with gravity and the ability to manipulate your pieces, the vitamins. However, Dr. Mario, you know, it has the aspect of different levels having a different degree of speed, just like Tetris, causing you to have to, you know, to think more quickly about what kind of moves you want to do, or you want to stack pills a certain way to take advantage of chain reactions, so that the Viri below you will be, you know, hit by the falling pills as well. You want to be as efficient as possible to get those points and to get through these levels before the pills stack up to a point where it's difficult to make your way throughout the game board. Dr. Mario, as well, as it's a competitive puzzle game, not only just doing a score attack for or seeing how far you can go, but a lot of versions have head-to-head, and these sort of block puzzle games often have a very competitive aspect to them, and sometimes the competitive thing is, you know, completely the point of them, like Super Puzzle Fighter. So that's a big thing with Dr. Mario as well, and for a lot of these, and I think not only are you competing against yourself when you play a puzzle game, when you add in someone else, it gets a lot more competitive and a lot more heated. So these games being so simple that anyone can pick them up, and very quickly, if you are able to rationalize puzzles, you start to see these patterns and possibilities for more advanced moves very quickly. And Dr. Mario is simply as simple as it is. Facilitates that. The one thing I want to mention to Dr. Mario, why I generally prefer to play Dr. Mario now instead of, say, Tetris, is that it has a lot of flavor. And Tetris has a lot of flavor, that the music is, you know, timeless, and it has sort of the little cutscenes in Tetris. Dr. Mario, the board is themed as a bottle, and the pieces you have to get rid of are very, and Dr. Mario's up there chucking pills in, You know,
with that certain charm flavor to it.
You know what? Even vitamins, I wouldn't take that many at that time. I don't think it's a particularly good prognosis if your doctor is just shoving that many pills into your virus culture. But, you know, I think this has a lot of theme. I love fever. I love chill. I want to get Dr. Mario 64 and so on and so forth. I got back into it recently with the Game Boy game. Big fucking surprise.
Yeah.
But I've been playing that off and on, and, you know, in terms of being competitive, I don't think I can necessarily beat anyone that's been playing Dr. Mario for a long time, but, you know, I'd like to get a little bit of two-player Dr. Mario in sometime as well. I think it's a lot of fun.
Well, there was that Wii one also, I think. The WiiWare, I believe. Did your mom play a lot of that one?
No, she didn't play Wii.
Oh, okay.
She plays a lot of Tetris on the game, and Dr. Mario on the NES is what she plays. Dr. Mario is nostalgic. Like, that's, I'm realizing all my games are on the fucking NES. Bus. I mean, these are my favorite puzzle games, so what have you.
Yeah, so my second puzzle game that I want to discuss is also color matching, although it comes, you know, a few years after Dr. Mario, so it's a bit more complex. It's Pinel de Pon. And first you might ask, Chris, why is it Pinel de Pon and not Tetris Attack? Well, the answer to that is, the way my life works somehow is that I got Pinel de Pon through the magic of the internet somehow. I'll just keep that vague. So, when I first played that, you know, I was really attached to it. It was really cute. I like Lip, and I like all the jewel stage. I don't remember their names anymore. It's been a long time. But, yeah. It was a really cute fairy aesthetic, and I got really hooked on that game. And then I was, like, at a friend's house, or it was probably a convention, and I hear Lip's theme, and I come running over going, I love Pinel de Pon, and I see Yoshi on the screen. I'm like, what the heck is this? So, yeah, that was my first experience finding out that Pinel de Pon was never localized here, but it technically was. It was just completely rebranded to be Yoshi. But anyway, yeah, so it is also a color-matching game, but because it's a Super Nintendo game, it's more complex in the way that it sort of builds up the color blocks as it goes up in the screen, and you don't want it to hit the top, of course, just like Tetris. But doing so, you can still, like, swap the tiles around, so you can sort of build up chains, and that's one of the big things about the Puzzle League series, I guess it's called now. And I guess it was just the aesthetic of Pinel de Pon and the memory of it is why I wanted to bring it up. But when it comes to, like, these types of puzzle games, I do like them, the more reflex ones. It's just the Puzzle League series, because I also like a lot of Puzzle Fighter. Puyo Puyo is kind of the same thing. It also has a different set of chains and how that works. But it's that kind of idea. Just I like the puzzle games where it kind of builds up and it has a competitive aspect to it. But if you get really good at understanding how the patterns and how setups work, you can come up with some really cool chains and combos to either clear the board really well, or you can also use to clear the board and then also wreck on your opponent. So, I guess I just have a lot of fun with that. I'm not very good at it, so if you ever play against me after all these years, I'm still terrible at it. But, I just really love Pinel de Pon.
Puyo Puyo actually had a bit of an identity crisis as well, because I played it as Kirby's Avalanche, and most people back then played this as the Mean Bean Machine.
Yeah,
both Pinel de Pon and Puyo Puyo are quite good. So Pokemon Puzzle League is Pinel de Pon.
Yeah, Pokemon Puzzle League is also a Pinel de Pon game. I've never played Pokemon Puzzle League, actually, which is surprising because it came out at a time I would still be really into Pokemon, and I would still like Pinel de Pon. But yeah, I guess that game just kind of went by me. I guess I was too busy playing Puzzle Fighter or something. Yeah, I've been trying to get my hands on it. And Pinel de Pon also, like, came out with sequels. There was one on the DSi, out of all things. I don't think we have a new game lately, so step it up, Nintendo Switch. Bring back Pinel de Pon. I want to see Lip and Thanny.
I'm sure we'll get some more of that kind of stuff.
Yeah, if anything, maybe it'll be another Pokemon spinoff. But, you know what? The Puzzle League games are fun, so yeah. Check it out.
So next I want to talk about the Solomon's Key series, but particularly Fire and Ice. This is what I consider an action puzzler. Now, I know that Tetris, Dr. Mario, and other games that we've talked about have a degree of action or reflex involved in them, but a game like Solomon's Key, it has a degree of platforming and enemies and all that, and it's about solving the puzzle of the room to progress. It's almost like you take a platformer or what have you and condense it to one room. The game I'm going to talk about next, not a platformer, but a similar kind of concept. But for Solomon's Key and Fire and Ice, the main mechanism is the creation and destruction of blocks in Solomon's Key, which is a brutal fucking game, to be honest with you. I didn't actually beat it because Fergus kicked the NES.
Oh, no.
So, I'll have to get back to it and clear.
Gotta get revenge on Solomon's Key.
Yeah. But Fire and Ice in particular, I want to talk about. Fire and Ice is easier than Solomon's Key, but it has a lot more flavor and personality. So, it's, again, about self-contained rooms where you need to reach the end without blocking yourself from completing it, and you have to douse all of the fire in each room of Fire and Ice. And depending on how it's set up, like, ice can be attached to a wall. If it's attached to a wall or attached to ice that's attached to a wall, it's not subject to gravity, but ice that is separated from a wall will drop, so you have to kind of figure out, you know, I'm going to break the ice here, here, and here so I can drop these blocks and generate enough ice that we can eventually, you know, drop them on these flames. And it sounds quite simple, and it is a concept, but the puzzles get progressively more difficult. There's boss fights that have a lot of character, but the boss fight is a puzzle, but, like, the fire in the boss fight will move, or the room will scroll or something. It adds these elements to it that, you know, it's still a maze or a puzzle, but it kind of adds these extra little elements to it. But what I like about Fire and Ice, in particular the theme, is that, you know, every world looks different, has a different color scheme, and even the little fireballs look different. Like, some have eyes as if Rareware fucking made it or something. Yeah, I mean, like, you can kick ice, or you can drop it and all that. It's a really cute game, really intricate game. I had to get the Famicom version Solomon no Kagi too, because the NES game is just really expensive. But it's one of my favorite NES games, so I had to get it. I recommend both Solomon's Key and Fire and Ice. Solomon's Key is a lot more demanding in terms of reflex and in terms of continues and things like that, but it's such a generic name, like Fire and Ice. Like, who cares? But, yeah, definitely give it a look. And you're going to notice, you know, not just the platform. You're going to notice a trend with why I like certain puzzle games as we go on.
So, and the last puzzle game I want to discuss about is kind of actually a point-and-click game, sort of. And what it really is a collection of a variety of puzzles within a narrative, and it's the Professor Layton series. And it's a narrative game because the story is about some archaeologist professor, actually, who just happens to love the heck out of puzzles, so when he goes out on his adventures, a bunch of people are coming up to him and going like, "Hi, I have a problem. Can you help me out with it?" And most of these puzzles are just because they're there. There's really no justification for it other than people just have issues, I guess. There are definitely plot-connected puzzles, and those are the ones you must solve, but, I mean, there are just a variety of puzzles in these games. There's word puzzles, there's not really reflex puzzles, but there's, like, sliding block puzzles, everyone's real favorite ones. There's stuff like, you know, decrypt a code, stuff like that. So, there's definitely a variety of them, and they're all just hidden in this story about a guy going on adventures. And I guess that's kind of one way to get me to really play a puzzle game, because I have played a lot of the Professor Layton series. It's four games. I started the fifth one. I think they're like at eight games now, maybe. But I guess the trick is if you really want me to get into a puzzle series, you just say there's a story attached to it and then throw all the puzzles in there. But I don't know. I think it's a really interesting approach to this. And, you know, it's fun trying to solve all the puzzles because there's, like, this thing you collect called Picarots for solving a puzzle. Like, you get 300, essentially, if you get it in one shot. But if you make a mistake, you'll lose some Picarots. I don't know what these Picarots are for. They're never explained. You just get them. They're like points. What do they do? But if you get something wrong and you lose Picarots, you're like, oh no, I'm not smart enough. And then you reset from your save and do it all over again, that kind of thing. So it's just really a fun game where, you know, as you follow the story and then you just get a variety of different things that you're trying to solve in the puzzle. Like, and you get a different set of them. And it's always like kind of challenging in different ways. The downside is sometimes you get puzzles that just make no sense whatsoever, so thankfully the internet's there. They're few and far between. They're not like the LucasArts puzzles like I brought up before. Sometimes it's just sort of like a word puzzle, and just the way maybe they translated or just the way it was written out just doesn't seem to connect for some reason. Or maybe the solution they were looking for is just a little strange in a way. I mean, this is sort of a ramble, but I remember in one of the games there was a puzzle about these guys playing poker, and you have to try to figure out why, what is in his hand or something, given the clues you have for this puzzle. And then, you know, I tried to consider, like, all the probability of what his hand is and stuff like that, and then you look it up, and it's like, how do you come up with that solution? It doesn't make any sense, but yeah. That's, yeah, but anyway, the point is, I think that's just a really interesting thing about the First Relay series. I mean, it's got a fun cast is another thing about it. It's got a really great music. It is point and click because you're just going around town talking to people, really, and solving the ultimate mystery in a way. But just like the little puzzles sprinkled in between and just the whole variety of them, and then more puzzles you get from, like, bonus modes. It's just a lot of fun in a way, and I just like how it has like a different approach to saying, yeah, here's a story, but also you want to do a word puzzle sometimes? Here you go.
A lot of what people have told me about it, it seems like the character is a big focus to it. But it's interesting to say sometimes the puzzles don't seem justified, but at least they try to get...
There is a hint system, but there's a separate currency called hint coins. But, you know, I want to be a completionist and not waste a single hint coin, so I'm just going to look at this puzzle for 30 minutes and try to figure it out.
Of course. Now, I haven't really played them. I have the second late in game, but when I got this post about it, you told me in terms not to play them or so. I haven't actually gotten the first one to play through them, but they do sound good. The DS, I think, was a bit of a renaissance for adventure games and for puzzle games. I know a lot of people liked Meteos and...
It had Tetris DS, all right.
It had Tetris DS, and as for adventure games, of course, Phoenix Wright blew up when it came over. And a lot of people have always put Professor Layton as, like, the alternate to Phoenix Wright, and they did cross over eventually.
They did cross over, yeah. But Phoenix Wright, I mean, when you think about it, is also a puzzle game, because it goes back to the whole adventure point-and-click games, where you just get some clues and then solve the mystery.
They're mostly traditional puzzles, just themed around the environment?
I would say the plot-specific puzzles that you have to solve to go on with the story would be more specific to the environment, or at least... The puzzle would be flavored for the environment, but sometimes some guy is just like, hi, I need help with something, and then you pull up the puzzle and it's like, hi, help me park my car correctly. Well, not park my car, but find the parking spot, that'd be great for me. And it's like, okay, sure, I guess. Obviously, yeah. Obviously, when you get in the beginning of the game, they're kind of simple, but then there's going to be some that are just, like, so out there, or, like, the bonus ones are often, like, here's a 300 movement puzzle sliding piece block thing.
Now, for my last game I'm going to talk about, and anyone that knows me to any degree probably saw this coming, because it's my favorite puzzle games of all time, and I'm talking about Eggerland, which is the greater series of Adventures of Lolo. Adventures of Lolo is sort of the localized name for Aegerland, with the original adventure of Lola being 50 stages from previous Aegerland games, sort of put together to introduce the series to North America. These games, they come in two varieties, Labyrinth versus Tower. A tower-style Aegerland is one room after the other, with Lolo in a predetermined starting position in each room. Or Labyrinth is when all the rooms are on a grid, and you can adventure throughout them. Some of them you can do out of order. Usually you have to find the right door to go through to actually solve a puzzle, but they're usually quite arcane, the Labyrinth ones. Prefer my favorite one being Aegerland to Meikyu no Fukatsu on the Famicom. Now, the reason I like Aegerland so much, and this goes towards why I like the puzzle games I just do, is that I've always considered it on three pillars, and that's reason, reflex, and theme. And for me, Aegerland hits the three of those right on the button in terms of the reason or puzzle-solving side of Aegerland. There's a lot of logic puzzles to this series set to Lolo. Basically, the room, the gist of lock chest, and if you collect all of the hearts or heart framers in every stage, you will unlock the chest and you can open the doors, proceed to the next room, but you have to push emerald framers or find egg shots in certain heart framers to temporarily kill or encase enemies as eggs, and then you can push the enemies while they're an egg to use them as a lock. It sounds simple on the outset, but some of the puzzles, particularly late in the Labyrinth style games, the Aegerland Labyrinths that you find in the Japanese releases or like pro levels of Adventures of Love 2, some of them become quite involved, especially since there's a lot of mechanics in Aegerland that you sort of have to learn. Like, if you block an enemy's respawn position, sometimes they will either be destroyed outright or they will respawn somewhere else. And so there's a little bit of trial and error in Aegerland, but once you kind of get a handle on some of the arcane mechanics of it, like the fact that you can run alongside certain enemies as long as you're only half touching them, not fully in their view, you begin to put things together as you look at the stage. So I think the logic and problem solving of Aegerland or Lolo is top notch. In terms of reflex, there's a lot of enemy types in the Adventures of Lolo, and once you open the chest, a lot of enemies might become active. The Gauls, suddenly they wake up and they can shoot fire. The Skulls will wake up and they can chase you, or et cetera, et cetera. And sometimes, sometimes it's a race to the ending. It's just very simple. Navigate the room backwards, get to the ending to solve it. But there's also reflex in terms of completing puzzle elements, because you can push an egg into the water and ride it across the water, but it will eventually sink. Or, you have to encase an enemy temporarily, but they only stay as an egg for so long. So there's a lot of reflex. And sort of the thing I've been talking about the entire show and tell has been theme. Like, this game's cute as fuck. There's no question about it. Like, I played through a game, the Dalian Opus, I think it might have been last year, and it's sort of a game where you have to take certain shapes and use them to create another shape, like the shape that they want you to create in the least amount of moves possible, which was a good thought exercise, but besides a little bit of flavor between stages, it was just blocks. I like my puzzle games to have a little bit of character to them. That's why I like Dr. Mario, that's why I like Fire and Ice, and that's why I like Lolo, because, you open up the chest and all of the snakies start waving back and forth like dancing. And it's like, that's fucking cute. And, theming them around a tower or a labyrinth, great theming. The game looks great. It has terrific enemies. All of them have personality. And I don't know. I think Nintendo would win E3 if they announced Lolo for the Switch. Just saying.
With my little knowledge of the Lolo series and whatever I know from you, I feel like most of the games are from the Famicom era. When was the last time they released a game? Like, what was the last console?
So the last Agerland game was released for Windows in 2000. It was Revival Agerland. Okay. Yeah, so it has sort of render graphics and it added crystal framers, which can bank your shots. So adding one new block to Agerland changes the whole game. And you'll notice if you play a lot of these games, when the puzzles are repeated throughout them, they might just be sort of flipped 90 degrees or something, or sometimes there's legacy rooms that you're like, oh, I've done this fucking one before and I'll never forget it, so I'm going to do it right away. But yeah, Revival Agerland 2000, I'd have to look at when I wrote my FAQ for it, because man,
I guess it has been a while. I guess Nintendo better come up with a new revival on the Switch then.
Yeah, because HAL's definitely not going to be putting it on Windows anymore, but...
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I'd love a revival. Another revival of Agerland. That was 194 rooms. I think that might have been the biggest set. I kind of forget. I used to know all that. This game has two FAQs, yeah. Both of them are mine.
Of course they are.
Well, because the game had a prequel, The Adventures of Lala. So, or The Quest of Lala, which was like a 32-room game where you played Lala. So, yeah. But I like Lolo. I like Lala, basically.
The real OTP for you?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know what? Lolo and Lala, they love each other. They're both capable. They're married. So Lolo is like, yo, he's the fucking king. He is the king of Edenland. And the, Agerland Labyrinth can't stop him. And they have a son, Lulu. And, you know, I question his taste in boots. But whatever, he's a good kid. So, you know, they're already OTP.
I learned a lot about puzzle games, but mostly about Lolo lore, and that's the important part.
Yeah, yeah. So we've talked about games that we personally consider games. However, puzzle and puzzle elements, you know, they show up in all sorts of games. They're so ingrained in the medium that you're hard-pressed to find a game that's not going to present you with some kind of puzzle. How do you feel personally about puzzle or puzzle-like elements in other styles of games? Do you find they break the flow of the game, or do they contribute to the level of world design?
I think it definitely depends on how well integrated the puzzle is to the setting. I can't really actually... I know there's so many, and I can't think of one right now. But I'm trying to imagine, like, if it was an FPS, and you need to defuse a bomb. I mean, that seems thematic enough with the thing. But if it's like, I don't know, I'm playing a shoot-em-up, and next thing you know, I have some puzzle in it for whatever reason. I'm sure that happened in a Treasure game, because Treasure does whatever it wants sometimes. Then that could be pretty off-putting. I wish I remembered when right now, because I'm sure I'd have a rant about it, or I would mention how it was actually cool that they added it in.
Puzzles and FPS that you mentioned often were the sort of the subject of a little bit back in the day, because it was always, you know, hit the switch or find the key, and that was the extent of the puzzle. But I don't mind that, honestly. I like sort of more involved FPS than I like sort of classic. I don't think find the key or hit the switch necessarily breaks the flow. An FPS I do like a lot, Hexen, might be the exception to that because you hit switches that affect things in other levels. In Hexen, I think that's a little bit crazy, but yeah. I think, like you said, it depends on how it's implemented, whether or not it impacts the game in that way or not. But if it's built into the core of the game, I think it's acceptable. Sometimes you're playing a game and all of a sudden you're roadblocked by something that's incongruous with the rest of it. And depending on how well that is executed, that can change a lot of perception about it, right? What genres in general seem to mesh well with puzzles? I mean, we just talked about FPSs a bit briefly. They're not always the best there, but what genres seem to mesh well with them?
I would probably say point and clicks, because as I've mentioned out with like Carmen Sandiego, where it's mystery, solving a mystery, or it's Professor Layton, which is also point and click, and also kind of still solving a mystery in a way. I just feel like if you want to put a puzzle in a game, that would probably be the best way to do it. Like, it's sort of an adventure game where you click something and it's like, oh, well, maybe we gotta figure out how to organize these books to open up the bookshelf for secret patches, that kind of thing, I think would work really well, and that's where puzzles really mesh well with a genre.
Yeah. I think for me, I would say RPGs. Mostly because a lot of the RPGs I like also include exploration aspects as well. So if you're exploring a tomb, it makes sense that there's going to be various traps and puzzles to solve to make your way through it. So I think that it meshes well in that kind of format. Not necessarily like the tales of games using the ring to hit things or whatever, but...
Yeah, I was just thinking about, oh man, Tales games is that so often, and I wish they stopped doing it sometimes.
Yeah. I've played plenty that don't have the puzzle element, but I do like when they do it, and I think it adds a lot in terms of world building because, hey, you're in this ancient tomb, of course it's going to have these aspects. So yeah, I think RPGs would be my choice. Is there any kind of puzzle you don't like to see in other genres?
I feel like in slower paced games, like again, back to the point and clicks, if I have to do a more reflex based puzzle, I feel like that would clash too much with sort of the pacing and how I approach the game. So that would kind of not mesh well. I wouldn't like that. Or since you just brought up RPGs, I don't kind of like it when Tales does it because it's always like, do a sliding block puzzle, and I just feel like that drags, and when you're playing Tales game, it's more of an action RPG, so you just want to go back into more fights.
Oh, I agree, Tales puzzles are... They're not difficult, they're just tedious and
they're tedious, and that's another thing. And when I think about puzzles and RPGs that I don't like, I go back to a Game Boy Advance game that I released, like a Golden Sun, and there's that log pushing puzzle, but it was like every single time you gotta push a log and go into your, like, use a shortcut to use your side to move the log, and it was just, I don't know. I feel like that just ruins the pace of the game, and also I have no patience sometimes.
So, mostly for you, it depends on the cohesion with the game. It makes sense in terms of what you're playing and where you find it.
Yeah. And maybe I just get so tired of, like, pushing these blocks. Maybe I don't like sliding block puzzles. How about that? I don't mind the stupid, on a square that you mentioned in the intro of the cast, but that depends on also where it's placed.
I fucking hate them. Now...
I mean, they're really simple. That's probably why. I don't know. It's just...
No, I know there's, like, it's not solving them that's the problem. It's simple. There's an algorithm to them. But I think that sliding puzzles, the sliding tile puzzles, are the laziest fucking addition to anything. Like, oh, you found this house in the Waker and it's got a fucking sliding puzzle. There are a series of sliding puzzles.
It's a series. Hell. I was going to say there's multiple ones, Matt, if you...
you're talking about a game series that, you know, is heavy on puzzles. And then if they take the most basic-ass, basic-ass, basic bitch puzzle there is, the fucking slide... block puzzle on a 4x4 grid. No, it's like...
I became really good at those because in Final Fantasy Dawn of Souls or whatever the heck it was called, Dawn of Sorrow? What is it? No, that's a new Castlevania game. They were all named the same at that era.
Yeah.
They added that sliding puzzle in in the ship, like, as a minigame, and I guess that was fine because it was completely optional, like, even more optional than Wind Waker, because Wind Waker was like, hi, surprise, there's, like, a piece of heart in here after solving it, I think, or something like that. It's been a long time. But, yeah, it was just super, super optional, so I got really good at that because I was doing a level 11 class challenge run or whatever it was called, and the only way to get items was doing that puzzle, so I became a master at doing them in, like, 2 seconds.
I guess that's the reason I don't like to see them, is because every time I see a sliding tile puzzle, I'm like, you know, are you talking with me here? Because, I don't know, I just think that it's, you could come up with something better, right? I just think you could come up with something better, and you should, than using the same puzzle that everyone uses and that, you know, kids got as a Happy Meal. Every 3 months. Of course, kids pop all the tiles out, and that's how they solve it. But, you know, and maybe I'm blowing it out of proportion. Maybe they don't show up quite as much as I like to think, but I usually just... I know the pipe dream a lot as well. I don't actually mind them. If you know, have you played Pipe Dream?
I probably played, like, the first one or something, but it's been, yeah, like, ages. Yeah.
But those connecting the pipes to get the liquid to point A.
Oh, yes, yes, I have played that. The old PC game from the olden days.
Yeah, I don't know what it's actually called. I just remember Pipe Dream. And, I don't know. You see, there was a lot, and I usually sigh about them, too, just because I've done them so many times. But they're they're at least a little bit more thought-provoking than sliding tiles.
I mean, okay, so... It's been 5 years of the aggregate, everyone knows we're Zelda fans. Like, I was gonna say, well, isn't Great Bay Temple technically a pipe dream? Like, but in an expanded dungeon?
Never really put that into perspective, but I think it's it's a bit more... maybe.
Complex than
that. I don't know. That's give me a bit of a aneurysm thinking about this. So, we talked about puzzles that you don't like to see. The next thing I want to talk about is a little bit contentious because there's a lot of people that hate these, and there's a lot of people that are okay with them or like them. How do you feel about puzzle bosses?
Now that depends. The first thought I will come up with is the Bed of Chaos in Dark Souls, and I definitely don't like that one. Not only because there is platforming involved in a game where you can't jump that well, if only it was Sekiro. But, I mean, it's Dark Souls because, I mean, at this point, you've learned that, okay, I gotta learn how to dodge, or I know how to, like, slam R1 a lot, but Bed of Chaos is just like, hi, go down this slide, and then learn that you have to hit the two things on the side, and then the bug in the center, while also dodging the stupid branch that will always get you every single time. And, I don't know, that puzzle boss is just amusing because I've seen so many, like, cheats on how to get around it, just like, why don't you just shoot the branches? Because if you just shoot the branches with a very specific aiming, then you don't need to do all the jumping. It's like, that's not a puzzle boss that's integrated well. On the other hand, if you want to bring up Sekiro, I'm going to be vague about this one because it's a new game. There is essentially a puzzle boss, but, I mean, it's not really a big of a deal. It's actually just solving where is this boss and how do I take care of it? Like, how do I approach it with the stealth, which is integrated into Sekiro? Or, like, can I use my items and catch up to it? Or am I paying attention to my environments and that's how I take care of one faction of this boss? So, I mean, it's a puzzle boss. I wasn't really liking it because I encountered it when I was really tired. But that one is at least more integrated into the gameplay that Sekiro is, and that's why I'm more receptive to that kind of puzzle boss.
Oh yeah, because I mean the Bed of Chaos. What other boss in Dark Souls, after you you know, beat a phase of it and die, that phase doesn't go away, right? Like, the little things that you have to pop stay popped. So they knew when they were doing it, and it's a right. That's why the Bed of Chaos is the way it is. In terms of puzzle bosses, I guess I'm in the same boat. Depends on how they're implemented. Now, I think there are a lot of people that are way too quick to call a boss a puzzle boss. If a boss requires or is easier when you use certain mechanics a game presents you, it doesn't mean it's a fucking puzzle boss. Right? Like, oh, this ice boss is weak to fire. That's a fucking puzzle. No, it's not. That's common sense, right?
Well, I would argue in the first Zelda game, maybe it was more of a puzzle boss, but as the series evolved, then it just became like, I mean, just hit the boss with something. Preferably the dungeon item, then that's not a puzzle anymore.
Yeah, no, I wouldn't, still wouldn't say they're puzzle boss. Some Zelda games still implement bosses that are a bit more of a puzzle, I guess. Especially the Oracle games have a couple. But yeah, I think people are too quick to call certain bosses puzzle bosses. Just because they have a weakness doesn't mean it's a puzzle. Like, are all of the Robot Masters in the Mega Man series, are they all... No. But yeah, I think that it depends on how well they're implemented. The one thing I'll say about true puzzle bosses where you have to solve a puzzle to defeat them is that it might not hold up to repeat scrutiny. Like the boss that you mentioned from Sekiro, the next time you play that part of the game, it's going to be over in a minute because you know what to do. You're aware of the patterns and weaknesses and all that and how to solve it right away. So a puzzle boss has to be exceptionally good to hold up to repeat scrutiny. I guess that's my only real big downside to them, because I like solving problems, so puzzle bosses don't bother me. It's just that if you play through the game again, they kind of lost their luster a little bit. We're not going to get exhaustive here. We're just going to pick maybe one game as an example of games that implement puzzles, you know, in some way. Either you want to talk about one that does well, or you want to talk about one that does it poorly. Do you have any examples of a game that implements puzzles that's not a puzzle game inherently?
So I want to say this as a very vague and cryptic way of trying to pitch this game, but 999, Nine Persons, Nine Doors, Nine Hours, whatever it is, everyone just calls 999. I'm going to say it is a narrative game. It's point and click also, because it's always going to be point and click for me. But I think the really interesting thing about 999, besides its narrative and how it really goes into psychology and all this other wild nonsense about time, you will play emotional Sudoku in that game, and I think it really pays off really well.
I have never gone through any of them, in spite of being able to play them, so maybe sometime. It doesn't have a puzzle at its core. Is it more like a visual novel?
Yeah, it mostly is a visual novel, which I guess is also like what Phoenix Wright is. It's a point and click, but a visual novel the same. They're intertwined.
I think we should have done adventure games as a podcast sometime. Maybe. Because I think you're pretty keen on them for sure. The game that I want to mention just quite briefly, because we talk about The Legend of Zelda a lot on the podcast, so I want to not talk about The Legend of Zelda. I want to talk about the Legacy of the Wizards, which is similar. It's an action on the NES, of course, but Legacy of the Wizards, it's sort of like Zelda in that you need items to progress, but you play as the Warzen family, or the Drazel family in its original Dragon Slayer form, and you collect items as certain members of this family and bring them back, and then you can use them the appropriate family member. So it's another game that takes place over Labyrinth, and mostly exploration. You're looking for the dragon sword to fight the dragon at the center of the labyrinth. You know, pretty basic stuff there. But every character has unique attributes. They have a unique range for their attack. They have a unique jump height. Like Pochi, the family dog, which turns into a monster when you use him in the labyrinth, is invulnerable to enemies, so Pochi can ride on enemies to go places where other characters couldn't, but his jump is very small. But in terms of more pure puzzle solving, Zem, the father, for instance, has gloves that allow him to push blocks in very precise ways. So it's, you know, you get to these areas in Legacy of the Wizard that You have to either manipulate blocks with some characters or destroy them. And this is like an old school map it out kind of game. Otherwise, you're never getting anywhere in it. Because it's long and it's grueling with a lot of arcane things to it. But there's so many character-specific puzzles and branches to the labyrinth that's why I want to mention this as a game that's the action, like shooting enemies with your magical ability, jumping and platforming and collecting money, going to shops, gathering items, heading back and getting your password and all that. But the puzzles are implemented in like really cool ways so that you can get each round with the four characters, and then eventually you'll be able to use the combined work of those four characters to have the fifth one, get the Dragon Slayer sword, and win the game. So, yeah, really cool game. Really unforgiving game at times, but I like how it did puzzles. So this has been a very loose podcast, but we're getting to the end of it all. We're going to just wrap up our thoughts about puzzles and puzzle games. Are puzzle games important to the identity of gaming?
Yeah, definitely, because there's always the reflex-oriented ones like Tetris. I mean, that is the classic puzzle game. But then, as I always go back to my point and clicks, yeah, I mean, it's just kind of part of the game where you just piece things together and then hopefully it won't be too out of the box for you to solve. So I think it always has its place. It just depends on how it's implemented, of course.
Yeah, I think it has a lot of importance as well, because when you boil a game down to its core elements, it's difficult to get more core than a puzzle game because, you know, Tetris or what have you, it's a very simple concept, but then you build on that concept, you add layers to it, and it's one of the very core mechanisms to games, and I think it resonates with a lot of people. We do puzzles from the moment we can open a coloring book or get a jigsaw puzzle or fit the right shape in the right hole. So it's just something that's so familiar to us, and I think that's why it's sort of important in games, because it adds that familiarity but also level of complexity. Yeah, I think they're definitely important and have shown that again and again. Now, generally, and we've sort of talked about this before, story and myself with theme, but in general, what does a puzzle game need for you to like it?
I think for in the case of more reflexive action puzzle games like Tetris, I think it just needs to look really good. It's all about presentation and how the sound is, of course. Because if I'm going to be looking at the screen trying to figure out chains, I want to make sure that, you know, all the colors kind of like pop and they don't melt together. Or if there's a voice acting in the game for whatever reason, you know, the voice acting isn't annoying. Something like that. So it's going to be presentation when it comes to like the reaction games too, because you're trying to, like, really focus in on what you're doing, but if you have, like, distractions or it just looks bad, it's just gonna, like, not help me at all trying to do what I want. And for other puzzle games, let's say something like Zelda, because I always go back to Zelda, I think it needs to be, one, creative and not just shoot the eye in the wall, but it also doesn't need to be tedious. I don't want to see sliding block puzzles. I mean, I know they're common, but I don't know. It just takes a lot of sometimes the action of the game because it's just a slow-moving block, and I just want to keep pushing forward and like hit things with a sword or something. So at least have it be more incorporated or something like that. And from what I know about Breath of the Wild, at least when they did dungeons in quotation marks and how they did puzzles, they did a lot more different approaches to it and kind of out of the box and multiple ways to solve a thing. So I'm glad they were branching out in that. And Yeah, I think I just like there being different approaches in action games to how a puzzle can be solved, like in Zelda's case, or if it isn't a point and click, just make it relative to the situation and not be too crazy.
So I mentioned when I was talking about Lolo, there's a few things I like puzzle game to have. I think when I mentioned that there's a lot of familiarity to puzzles, I think that can sort of work against it sometimes too, and I like puzzle games that set themselves apart to be different. You know, you can change the look of a character, but it'll be the same game at its core, right? And I think when puzzle games are so ingrained in the identity of video games, you really have to do something unique or fresh with it to make it really stand out. Or you could put a mole in it, and I'll love it. But you talk about the adventures of Lolo as compared to, say, Kickle Cubicle. Kickle Cubicle is another manipulating blocks and such on a grid. Kickle Cubicle does things completely differently. I think it requires its own identity. I like theme, I like flavor and all that, but I will get hooked into any puzzle game that, you know, does something original, because it's generally one of the more compelling kind of games, because you can taste the solution, you want to get it, or you know you could do better next time, and that kind of keeps you coming back. So, as I mentioned, the podcast has been quite loose, quite nebulous. We've kind of given our opinions the whole way through. Are there any final thoughts you want to put down about puzzle games?
When you first pitched this podcast to me, I was trying to think of what puzzle games do I even really play? But yeah, as I thought about it more, then you could suggest the more reflective ones. So I was thinking about, you know, Puzzle League, Penalty Pond, stuff like that, Puyo Puyo. But then it really got down to, like, yeah, all those point-and-click games that I played, those really are the core to me of just putting clues together and solving a mystery. That kind of thing is really what a puzzle is to me when I think about my experience with it in games. And it does have a lot to do with nostalgia, with my basis being Carmen Sandiego. And I mean, there are lots of pretentious answers I could go, like Dark Souls is kind of a puzzle game, because look how much time I spend on lore and then piecing it together with three. Like, that, in this case, is a sort of meta-puzzle. But yeah, it's really welcoming games, because I can't get away from it.
I mean, once you start, stop and think about the games that you like, you start to realize how much of that game could be puzzle-related, or how much of what you remember about a game is a puzzle. I often remember the enemies or a boss or a line of dialogue or a puzzle. It's one of the standout moments for people. Sometimes not in a positive light, mind you, but it's usually something that you remember. Yeah, I mean, in final thoughts about puzzles, we've basically said it the whole way through. I like them, I like problem solving, and as long as they're implement this, like you said, in a cohesive way, or sometimes even in a non-cohesive way, is even better. I just like doing them, and if they make sense for the game, I like doing them. And if the game is really games, then I get really into them, and I'm thinking about them when I put the controller down. And I think for me, that kind of marks a puzzle game that's done its job, is when I put it down and I'm thinking about it afterwards. Like, say, someone's played Tetris. I know it's come up a lot in the podcast, but thinking about playing the maximum starting speed and maximum amount of garbage on the screen, and you're thinking about how you performed under those constraints, or you're thinking about how far you went starting from 0-0, how far did you go and how far can you go next time? There's certain genres that sort of make you think like that, but puzzle games do it quite often. And there's, I mean, of course, when you turn a game off, you're thinking, oh, how's the story going to progress? Puzzle games are one of those genres that you're thinking more, how can I do better or how can I do this, rather than what's going to happen next. And I think that's what makes them compelling. So that's been our podcast for June 2019. You know, just talking kind of loosely about puzzle games.
The real puzzle is how incoherently I've been speaking, so you have to figure out what the heck I'm saying.
Speaking of you, Chris, where can we reach you?
You can reach me at twitter.com/Karasu, CAWRASU.
And where can we reach Arrow?
You can reach Arrow at AGROCST, also twitter.com.
And you can reach me at twitter.com/Metazoic, MATTOZOIC. It's like the Mesozoic era, except the dinosaurs are better. Website's the same, metazoic.com. Chris, what are we doing for July?
Yeah, July's my birth month, so I get a cool special choice. And this time, I want to return to Pokemon Crystal.
Pokemon on the Aerocast, the Aerocast 1E3. So, yeah, I'm kind of looking forward to playing that as well. It should be fun. We've never really talked about our history with Pokemon, and we both have some, so...
Yeah, I think my tweet is still on the Agrocast Twitter. I wrote, "Eugene is a fucking bay," or something like that. So I guess we'll go elaborate on that when we return to Pokemon Crystal, yeah.
Forgot about that. But yeah, we'll find out next month. Same Arrow time, same Arrow channel. See you then. Cheers.
Cheers.
Do you have the skill? Do you have the speed? Do you have the coordination to be Pokemon Puzzle Master? You have what it takes to face your toughest opponent yet. The Wall. New Pokemon Puzzle League pits you against 16 trainers in Pokemon's biggest challenge of them all, The Wall. Can you master it? A legion of Pokemon say you can. New Pokemon Puzzle League, rated E for everyone, only on N64.